Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Feel Your Fandom Podcast. My name is Saint.
I'm Jim.
Yes, I didn't sleep well last night either, Jim. How about you?
Oh man, I haven't slept well since the Clinton administration. I don't know what the fuck is going on, but I'm in the run-up, you were asking me, hey man, how you doing? You look a little tired. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I have so much shit going on, so many irons in the fire that if my cognitive function was firing on all cylinders, which it isn't because of lack of sleep, I'd be able to remember when sleep was a thing. But, you know, as it is, I just have way too much shit to do. But, you know, it's 2024, so if I get off the hamster wheel, the entire apparatus of machinery that I built around myself to keep my life running will collapse.
And
the house of cards crash. So, gotta keep moving. Ever forward.
I wanted to get one of those for my cats. You know, they got those big like hamster wheels for cats.
Yeah.
Have you seen those? And I kind of wonder what my little tubby cat would do on that thing. But I don't have enough room in this small ass house for it, so I can't even keep myself alive, much less a pet. What the hell?
Yeah, that really is the stage that you get to when you're an adult, when you have like apps on your phone, when you're monitoring your blood sugar and your caloric intake and all this, and you realize that's what the Tamagotchi was trying to prepare me for. The little animal I'm trying to keep alive now is myself. But yeah, bring on the apps, I guess.
I sucked at the Tamagotchis too. But
yeah, they all died. So what does that tell you?
I keep putting these stupid sensors in my arm every month, and they're doing something. My blood sugar's gone down, so that's good. I'll take it. But
I have one. Yeah. It's right here, but I haven't had
it on.
I know. I got to wear it. I got to put it in, but it's one of those things. It's kind of like shaving your pubes or dyeing your beard, at least one of which I do. I'm not telling you which. But once you do it, you kind of have to keep it up. You know, suddenly things start to grow out. And you go, oh, that either itches or I got gray roots. Again, not speaking from experience, either one of those things. But I'm worried that, like, I put this thing in my arm. And once I do that, I'm going to have to keep doing it. So I'm just, like, delaying the inevitable at this point.
Yeah, I really didn't want a visual in my head of you shaving your crotch to get rid of your gray roots. But
like I said, man, I don't necessarily say that that's what I'm doing. I'm just, you know, one of these things is a thing that I do, and you can use your imagination, looking at my face, as to which one of those I do.
My imagination is a terrible place to be left unattended. I'm just saying.
Don't I know it?
man, it's been a busy week.
Yeah.
Holy shit, the band and I are preparing for a gig. We have a gig this next Friday as we record. So 1 week from today or whenever you hear this. We're going back up to that bar in Linwood that we used to like. It was a pirate bar for a long time. Now it's something called Club Hectic. And I've not been in there since. But I know the hosts, the guys who own the bar now, run a show on Amazon called Band Wars. And so I've seen some of the shit that they get up to in there. I don't know, man. I don't know if I can hang. It's crazy. I'm going to have to get wicked drunk to find out if I can hang. So we'll see. But
I went to a pirate theme bar once. I tried to get a drink by flagging down the barmaid by screaming yo-ho, and then I found myself entirely unable to cradle my freshly kicked testicles on account of the pepper spray. So I have to watch myself. Yo-ho-ho
and a bottle of rum. Shiver me timbers.
They be shivered.
Other than that, we don't even know who we're playing with. We've gotten so little information from these promoters that it's really hard to promote the show. That's like, oh, yeah, everyone come out and see, you know, us. Oh, who are you playing with? Maybe someone. Maybe we're playing the whole night by ourselves. Fuck it. But
I guess we'll find out.
Hope you like hearing
the
same thing three times. Let's go. Wow. But so that's next weekend. Got to get ready for that. And then, busy. Got some job interviews lined up. I'm trying to get out of the shuttle driving route and get into something a little bit more physically active. Because I realized that sitting on my fat duff for 3 years has made my duff even fatter. But also, like, it started to deteriorate my muscle and cartilage in my bones, for God's sakes, because I'm not getting enough movement. I'm not active enough. And so to kind of push that off, I'm looking into jobs like Amazon Delivery or FedEx or things like that, just something that keeps me up and moving. So I got a couple interviews for that. We'll see how that goes. Wish me
Well, I
luck.
just got paid today at my job, and one of the things that I talked about, I went to diabetic education a couple of weeks ago. That's where
Okay.
they gave me the arm monitor I haven't put in yet. But
Amazing.
one of the things that the gal I talked to talked about, she told me to start adding collagen peptides in with my morning protein smoothie, because she said you're getting way too much protein, which I didn't think that was a thing, but apparently I have some liver panel numbers that are spiking a little bit because I'm drinking like. Well, I'll make a protein shake with 2 scoops of protein powder in it that has 13 grams of protein in each scoop, and then I'll put like a container of Oikos Triple Zero 15 grams of protein yogurt into it. So I'm getting like 65 grams of protein. And she said that's probably too much. So substitute one of those scoops of protein powder with some collagen peptide. It'll be good for your skin. It'll be good for your hair. It'll be good for your nails. Good for your joints. So I'm going to try that. I ordered some on Amazon earlier, and when it gets here, I'm going to start seeing if that does anything for flexibility and all of that. All those things that tend to go to shit when you get older and things don't work as well anymore.
As I tend to,
We are so old.
Oh, I had to retire. You remember I told you I bought a bunch of those jerseys from Temu, and I've been rocking like hockey jerseys, and I got a nice Jason Voorhees fake autographed hockey jersey, and I got like all those Bad Boy Records jerseys, which
Bum
I've
bum
now
bum.
taken and put to a side of my closet that will not be accessed. It's not a good time to be a fan of Bad Boys Records, as it turns out. We
No.
did talk about Diddy the other about 2 weeks ago. So those have been retired. Instead, I ordered from Temu. I ordered replacements, and they're just plain, just regular, plain baseball jerseys, which is less exciting, but also less seemingly promotional of a very potentially troublesome individual, we'll say.
Yeah, given
Troublesome.
our shared history fighting predators, it's we got to watch out if we even give the appearance or a head fake of aligning with somebody who is basically being hauled up on federal charges for sex trafficking. But life is complicated, and never meet your heroes,
Oh,
I guess.
I guess I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop with that. I really don't want to hear anything bad about like Biggie Smalls or anything like that, but I know it's probably coming. I know it's probably coming, but anyways.
Probably.
Well, we have a little bit of news today before we get into our special guest today. I'm excited. We have a guest on the podcast, first guest this season, so I'm excited about that. But we have some news that we need to cover prior to that. First and foremost, we got a couple of celebrity deaths that we need to cover. The first one is actually kind of sad. I don't know a lot about the actor in general, only what I've read through these articles. But it's difficult to find out where to sit on this. His name was Cole Brings Plenty, who was a native actor. I guess he was in 1923, the Yellowstone spinoff with Harrison Ford, and he recently went missing. They did like a APB, all points bulletin out for him. He went missing after a suspected domestic assault, and then later they found his vehicle, and then they found him, or what was left of him at that point. So. It's difficult as a death goes in a young actor. Again, 27 years old. We talked about a 27 seems to be a bad year to be alive. I'm glad I made it past my 27,
Amen to that.
but potentially troublesome as far as we don't know if this guy did or didn't do it. We may never know now definitively, but he was a young Native American actor who had a lot of potential, and to see it kind of squashed this early is kind of sad, especially when it's nice to see representation of all stripes. We've always
For
said that,
sure.
and just to have a positive representation of that get cut down like this is just kind of a big blow.
Definitely is.
Another celebrity, well, celebrity, was a celebrity, is a celebrity, I don't know.
It's hard.
O.J. Simpson has finally shuffled off the field.
The juice is loose.
We ran out of juice, apparently.
Yeah.
But O.J. Simpson died age 76. Of course, anyone who doesn't know who O.J. is here on the wrong podcast because we only talk to olds like us, probably, so.
We are so old.
I don't know, but anyone who knows, O.J. Simpson used to be a football player. I believe it was for the Buffalo Bills. And then went on to have an acting career, after fame for, you know, after his football career. And most famous, of course, for the alleged murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. And, well, at least we say alleged because he was acquitted of the murder in criminal court.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
But was convicted in, what is it, not, what's the other court? Not criminal,
He's found liable in civil court.
Civil court, yeah. And so, and then the idiot went out and ghost wrote a book called If I Did It. It's like, come on, dude.
What the fuck were you thinking? And then later on, he did wind up, because, you know, justice, the wheels of justice move slowly, but they do catch up. He got
squeaky and slow, but.
Yeah. He got convicted of later on of, I believe it was a fraud charge for some sort of like either selling fake sports memorabilia or merchandise or something. I don't know.
He stole memorabilia from there someone that he claimed stole it from him, but it was like his memorabilia and shit. So it's like he went to jail for like stealing his own jerseys back or something to that effect.
Yeah, it's just a day of problematic sports jerseys here on the Feel Your Fandom podcast. Sure, I guess. It
is. But here's the idea now is like it instantly blew up all over the internet. He is a meme. OJ is big and popular and memey again because, I sent you one right before we started recording again.
Yeah.
As of yesterday when OJ was found dead. From cancer, by the way. The Bronco Sport, the Ford Bronco Sport, was also issued a recall. And so the Ford Bronco, of course, being notable for the vehicle that he made his slow-speed escape from police in before his trial.
Because that's what innocent people do. They run from the cops.
Right. But the joke now is that OJ and the Bronco got recalled on the same day, so
I don't know. The meme machine has definitely fired up and started to work overtime. Somebody sent me a meme the other day that I had to look at two or three times to understand why they were sending it to me, and it was just somebody taking a picture of a row of jugs of orange juice at the grocery store that said expires April 11th on them, and I thought, what does that have to do with that? Oh, you got it. Took me a second.
And yeah, then I didn't even get that. You sent me that one, and I didn't even understand. I'm just like, oh, I guess you better drink that quick.
Yeah, and then the other one with the casket hopefully will fit better than the glove did. Just, you know, people are – anybody who remembers – I think it was the 1990, you know, which, again, the 90s were only 10 years ago, but it still feels like it was a lot longer ago than it was. I remember watching it on television in high school and just, you know – yeah, so OJ, dead but not missed. I actually saw a TikTok earlier today of Cato Kalin, if anybody remembers Cato from the trial.
His former roommate.
Yeah, he was making a statement. Somebody said, Cato got on and said, somebody asked me to give my thoughts on OJ, and he spent a good probably 90 seconds talking about his condolences for the families of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. And said nothing about OJ, and I thought, well, that really speaks volumes. That says it all.
That's probably the smartest thing Cato's ever done.
But, you know, gotta say, he actually looks great, so good for him.
Yeah, my other favorite meme, and we'll leave it at this, was that Norm Macdonald was one of his most vocal critics on Saturday Night Live.
Famously got fired for picking on him.
In his book, OJ Simpson says that he would have taken a bullet or stood in front of a train for Nicole. Man, I'm going to tell you, that is some bad luck when the one guy who would have died for you kills you. That's garbage. You don't get worse luck than that.
Right. And so the picture was the pearly gates in heaven. Norm MacDonald going, huh, I don't see him.
It's LJ died. Where's he at? Nobody, are you sure he's, I don't see him around anywhere.
I thought that was pretty funny, so.
This comes from Unilad.com, and I thought this was really funny. The headline on this is, J.K. Rowling says she'll never forgive Emma Watson and Daniel Radcliffe. Which I think is pretty disingenuous, because I'm not sure that's the direction the contrition necessarily needs to flow in. But here's the article. Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling has indicated she will not forgive actors Emma Watson or Daniel Radcliffe for showing their support for trans rights. Rowling's comments come years after controversy surrounding the author, who's been accused, again, like OJ was accused, of being transphobic in posts shared online. In June 2020, Rowling appeared to make light of efforts to be inclusive to the trans community as she shared a link to an article titled Opinion, Creating a More Equal Post-COVID-19 World for People Who Menstruate. Alongside the link, Rowling commented, people who menstruate, I'm sure there used to be a word for those people. Someone help me out. Wumbin, wimpened, woomed. So basically, she's a TERF, which, if you are not aware, that stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. She is so bound up in her identity as a woman that she cannot accept other women just because their birth certificate did not indicate that they were born that way. So, and in years since, she's had plenty of opportunity. People have said, so how do you really feel? And she has doubled, tripled, quadrupled, and quintupled down on this anti-trans position. Yeah. And it's just really, really sad, because this woman created a universe and a set of characters and a story that resonated with several generations. She was even hailed as progressive, because several books in, she revealed that there was a major, major pivotal character in this universe, i.e. Albus Dumbledore, who had been gay the whole time, and it didn't matter. It was the least interesting thing about him. He was just gay, and that was all there was to it. But now she's on this anti-trans train, and it just... it breaks my fucking heart, and it breaks the hearts of many, many people. If there's ever been a larger scale example of fans of a certain thing being forced to separate the art from the artist, I don't know that I've seen it. I mean, we've got a lot of problematic musicians. We've got a lot of actors who are getting up to shady shit. I mean, shit, we just talked about Diddy. But this woman is out there showing her ass every day about how hateful she is. And it breaks my heart, makes me sad. But she's saying that... she's not going to forgive them. Daniel Radcliffe apologized for the pain Rowling's comments had caused and wrote an essay for LGBTQ organization The Trevor Project, and Emma Watson told her trans followers that she and so many other people around the world see you, respect you, and love you for who you are. And while Joe Rowling, she just can't abide by that. She'll never forgive them. I don't think they're asking for that. And they're not the ones who need to be forgiven.
They're absolutely not.
No. They're not the ones who need forgiveness. You dried up old prig. Fuck you. I just can't say enough awful things about this woman for creating this beautiful universe and then shitting directly on it and in front of all those people that, because it's not even just that it was, I had a wide fandom. This was a fandom that celebrated the misfits, the people who were different, the people who felt like they didn't belong anywhere else. And a lot of people, whether they were neurodivergent or whether they were disabled or whether they were somebody who was in the LGBTQ community, identified with this, hey, maybe society wants to show you the door, but here's a place where you can be accepted. Here's a place where what's different about you makes you special. And she just shit all over it. And it's so tough to see. But yeah, if I were her, I wouldn't go looking for any forgiveness from them either, because, they're not the ones
who
should be sorry.
Well, the dumb thing is... she didn't have to do much. She didn't even have to necessarily agree with their point of view. All she had to do was shut the fuck up. Don't fucking say anything. Don't throw your two cents in the fucking ring. We get it, Joe. We get it. Now shut up. And things could have blown over. Things could have smoothed out. But no, like you said, at every fucking turn, she chooses to show her whole ass. Yep. And it's just... I don't know.
And now they have this supposed reboot happening on Netflix that she's very involved with, or Netflix or Amazon Prime something. And I really hope it crashes and burns and fails. I will not be watching it, which, I know that's very heroic. But, at the same time, we all vote with our wallets. We all vote with our attention. And, I won't be checking out anything else she's ever involved with again for the future. I can't unread the books that I read, and I did love them. I can't unsee the movies that I saw. I love those too. But I don't love her because she's full of hate. So... I will not be checking out anything else she ever does in the future.
Nor will I. That's why I never felt bad about bootlegging, getting those bootleg Harry Potter wands. Because my kids like Harry Potter. They like the movies, but I won't buy the official shit. But they can have, like, Timu wands. That doesn't bother me at all. Speaking of people who like to show their entire asshole, let's talk about Gina Carano again, shall we?
Oh, Christ on a bike. Because please.
We talked very recently about how Gina Carano was filing a lawsuit against the Disney Corporation with the help of Elon Musk, because she was silenced on Twitter. She's filing a lawsuit for wrongful termination and things of that ilk against Disney. Disney has now fired back about the lawsuit, saying, quote, "She has grotesquely trivialized the Holocaust." This is coming from an article from Deadspin. Disney Corporation has insisted that the Elon Musk-backed action should be tossed out on the grounds that Disney has a constitutional right not to associate its artistic expression with Carano's speech, such that the First Amendment provides a complete defense to Carano's claims. Claiming her quote-unquote words were consistently twisted to demonize and dehumanize me as an alt-right wing extremist during the very public dispute 3 years ago, Carano took the Bob Iger run company to court in early February to get back her high profile Mandalorian role. Like they're ever going to rehire you. But Disney has now come out swinging. Quote, "Carano's social media usage sunk to its nadir on February 10th, 2021. On that day, she reposted an Instagram post from user Warrior Priest Jim Podcast. The post read, quote, 'The Jews were beaten in the streets, not by Nazi soldiers, but by their neighbors, even by children. Because history is edited, most people today don't realize that to get to the point where Nazi soldiers could easily round up thousands of Jews, the government first made their own neighbors hate them simply by being Jews. How is that any different from hating someone for their political views?'"
Oh, how is that any different? Babe, where do I fucking start?
Quote, "Disney had enough. The same day Carano grotesquely trivialized the Holocaust as comparable to sharp political disagreements, Lucasfilm announced that Gina Carano is not currently employed by Lucasfilm and there are no plans for her to be in the future. Nevertheless, her social media posts denigrating people based on their culture and religious identities are abhorrent and unacceptable." To which a month later, Disney's former CEO explained that Carano's views didn't align with the company's values, including its values of respect, decency, and integrity, and inclusion. So that's why she's suing. She's saying she's been taken off the board because of that, and she wants her job back. Like they're ever going to give her job back.
Kind of, reminds me, harkens back to the OJ thing we just talked about. On the roster of bright ideas, hey, you know what? I'm going to run from the cops. That's definitely top three. But hey, guess what? I work in Hollywood, and I'm going to be anti-Semitic. That's definitely neck and neck for stupid. And I'm not trying to say, don't get it twisted, I'm not trying to say, oh, Jews run Hollywood, but there is a very large number of people who are Jewish people who work in entertainment. It's just a very viable career field. And there, it's not a racist thing to say there's a lot of Jews in Hollywood. There are. And a lot of them are in positions of power and they do a fucking fantastic job. So to sit there and mouth off and be anti-Semitic while you are trying to have an acting career, I mean, it'd be wrong under any circumstances. But, that just adds an extra layer of idiocy to the entire proceeding.
What are you?
An idiot sandwich.
So they're just going back and forth now, button heads. Gina say, I want my job back. They fired me for they're cutting against my First Amendment rights. And they're like, well, you're cutting against our First Amendment rights. We have the right to not let you say that around our people. We have the right to not let you represent us. So.
And as much as J.K. Rowling lives in the UK and Gina Carano is here and there's people about it, I can't help but trace back this whole movement of I'm not just wrong, but I'm aggressively wrong, and I'm going to double down on being aggressively wrong thing. It just really all goes back to Trumpism. I mean, again, Josh, not a political podcast, but we've made this point several times before, that when you lift up the rotten log and let all the vermin scurry off from underneath who haven't seen the sunlight in a while. For a long, long time, people who hated, people who were racist, misogynist, homophobes, transphobes, xenophobes, these people had been shamed into silence over generations of being told and having it hammered into their inch-thick little skulls, hey, hatred is bad. This should be self-evident, but we understand that some of you are fucking morons and you don't understand that. But you should be ashamed of the way you feel, and you're going to be shunned by polite society because of this. And so we can't really change your attitudes. We can't get inside your head and rewire your defective fucking brains, but we can let you know that this shit is not going to play. We're not going to put up with it in public. And if you express this shit in public, you're going to be shamed for it. You might even lose jobs. You might lose relationships. You might be drummed out of social circles. And that's just the price you pay for being a fucking bigot. But then Trump came along and he recontextualized bigotry into patriotism. And now here we are a couple years later, and we have people like Joe Rowling doubling down on her transphobia. And we have anti-Semites like Gina Carano saying, hey, I'm suing to get my job back. No, there's still no room for you. You may have been told by this charlatan, this con man, this fucking golden calf, that your idiocy and your bigotry are good, but they're still not. And you're still going to fuck around and find out and suffer the sparkling consequences of being a giant bigoted asshole. And, you know, you might feel like you can express these things, but you're still going to find out.
A lot of the news today kind of follows the same vein. In a lesser degree, we got another story coming up here. This is from an article from ComicSans.com. Billy Dee Williams is called out after claiming actors should be able to wear blackface. First of all, the fuck? Billy Dee Williams, who of course played Lando Calrissian in the original Star Wars trilogy and beyond, has gone on the Bill Maher's podcast. And he was kind of spouting a bunch of shit. Let me see if I can find it here. The 87-year-old black actor, famous for playing Lando Calrissian in the original Star Wars trilogy, has a conversation with Bill Maher about the long stigmatized practice of non-black actors wearing makeup to portray black characters. Oh boy. Billy Dee Williams insisted, if you're an actor, you should do anything you want to do. The conversation arose during an episode of the Club Random with Bill Maher podcast when Williams recalled being amused by Laurence Olivier's portrayal of Othello in the 1965 film adaptation of the eponymous Shakespearean tragedy. The ethnicity of Othello has long been debated, but the character is referred to as the Moor.
Not really? Yeah.
An ambiguous term describing people with darker skin tones. Williams said of Olivier's performance in the film, quote, he stuck his ass out and walked around because, you know, black people are supposed to have big asses. To which Maher responded that it was problematic, which he continued, Billy Dee Williams continued with saying, I fell out laughing. I thought it was hysterical. The awkward discussion prompted Maher to comment on the political backlash from Bradley Cooper wearing a prosthetic nose to portray composer Leonard Bernstein and Maestro. Williams maintained that he, quote, loved that kind of stuff, to which Maher replied, I agree, but here's the thing. Today they would never let you do that. When Williams asked why, the host leaned forward and reiterated, blackface? To make sure they were on the same page. Why not? Said Williams, confirming. You should do it. Stunned, Maher chuckled and told the actor, that's your point of view. Williams doubled down by saying that actors should do anything they want to do, to which Maher post noted that there would be consequences, saying, quote, that's a great point of view, but the theater would be bombed. Williams' take did not go over so well online, as you might well imagine. We've talked about notable exceptions to that, Robert Downey Jr.'s take as Kirk Lazarus in Tropic Thunder, and how that was just groundbreaking in the audacity, first of all, but it worked because of its subversiveness. It's not like doing it just to do it. It's not like, you know, it was subversive on purpose, like Blazing Saddles was.
Right. They're not casting a white actor to play a character of color. They're lampooning that practice. And it's incredibly sensitive, and you have to do that in a way that is so delicate. They really only pulled it off once in Tropic Thunder. But, and like Blazing Saddles, like again, like it's, we covered that in the Movies You Could Never Make Today episode, but Blazing Saddles, even at the time, you know, is there harsh language in it? Yeah. Is there a lot of racism in it? Yeah. Do they drop the N-word a whole bunch of times? They sure do. But the thing is, they put the racism into the mouths of the biggest idiots on screen in order to lampoon how fucking ridiculous it is. It's an incredibly fine line, and it has to be done with an incredibly deft touch. But, you know, Mel Brooks did it. You know, Tropic Thunder did it. But this whole thing, again, it's a very delicate balance. All of it is a delicate balance. To have colorblind casting. We talked about things like, you know, Michael Clark Duncan do an amazing job as Fisk in the original Daredevil movie with Ben Affleck. He sure did, you know? But then we look around at other, even just staying in the same basic Marvel universe, even though Daredevil wasn't MCU at the time. You look at Tilda Swinton being cast as the Ancient One, when typically that character is Tibetan, and you think, you know, the difference is, and I think we didn't really solve the problem. We certainly didn't come up with any radical social solutions during that episode. But I think we figured out that if you are punching down, if you are casting an actor of privilege in a role of an actor who is marginalized or a character who is marginalized, that's where the problems come in. If you're casting an actor who might be of an underrepresented demographic playing somebody who, you know, is nebulous or whatever, then it works. But you just have to be careful, because if you say, like Billy Dee Williams did, hey, anybody can play anything, the two examples that I can think of is, well, we had an incredibly sympathetic and correctly lauded portrayal in Who's Eating Gilbert Grape with Johnny Depp and Leonardo DiCaprio, where Leonardo DiCaprio, mm-hmm. as a young actor, played a severely mentally disabled man, and he did it, and it was brilliant. It was wonderful. But then you turn around and you say, well, where does that stop then? If you just kind of say, open it up and say anybody can play anything, like Billy Dee Williams did, then you wind up with Mickey Rooney as Mr. Yuniyoshi in Breakfast at Tiffany's, doing yellowface with big fake teeth in and doing an incredibly offensive Japanese accent. So, it's tough. It really is tough to know where the lines are, but it really is a gut check sort of thing, where you can look at certain things and go, that just ain't fucking right. And other things, you look at it and you go, okay, that works. And maybe it is a sort of Supreme Court definition of pornography sort of thing. Like, I know it when I see it, which doesn't really come up with any hard and fast rules anybody can follow. And it does open you up to risk if you try and do something like that. But man, at least I can come out and definitively say that, that you probably shouldn't do blackface. Although again, like, Billy Dee Williams is an actor of color, so that's his personal opinion on it, and he would be somebody who's got much more of a valid opinion than I do on the matter, just because he's black. So I, you know, it's a really sticky thing to do, and there's no real right or wrong answers to it. But just, you know, like we talked about with the Cole Brings Plenty thing a minute ago, representation is never a mistake. That's one thing we can definitely all agree on. Representation is never a mistake.
Billy Dee Williams is a recipient of the NAACP Image Award and Lifetime Achievement Award. He followed up the statement by saying, quote, "The point is, you don't go through life feeling like I'm the victim. I refuse to go through life saying to the world I'm pissed off. I'm not going to be pissed off 24 hours a day." That part I could jive with. I really can. But it's the other bit that's a bit kind of cringy and makes my soul hurt a little bit, because once you open the doors and say that anybody could play anything, all of a sudden, like you said, yellow face is going to be okay. Red face is going to be okay. Black face is going to be okay. You know,
it's going to be. And hey, let's put Brendan Fraser in a fat suit while we're at it.
Oh yeah, that too.
And we got a couple more stories we're going to breeze through really quickly here before we bring our guest on. But this is from Rolling Stone. I hadn't even heard this was happening, but apparently now it's not happening at all. A Jon Snow Game of Thrones spinoff is firmly on the shelf, says Kit Harington. The actor admitted the proposed project was put aside after the creative team failed to find the right story. A Game of Thrones spinoff centered on Jon Snow is no longer in development, said actor Kit Harington in a new interview to Screen Rant. Harrington said the project is currently off the table because we all couldn't find the right story to tell that we were all excited about enough. He continued, so we decided to lay down tools with it for the time being. There may be a time in the future when we return to it, but at the moment, no, it's firmly on the shelf. Now, I'm not a Game of Thrones fan, as we have established earlier. I saw a couple of sort of one-off episodes when I was hanging out with friends and it happened to be on, and it just struck me as being incredibly hard to follow and very boring. And every
It's
one of my
dense.
every one of my friends that I was watching it with, well, I just gotta watch this. I gotta watch the episode to avoid spoilers. They're coming out online tomorrow and everything else. And so I would watch the episode, and admittedly, I didn't follow the story. I didn't know anything about the story, but I just watched these episodes. And to the person, every one of my couple of friends that I watched episodes with felt they needed to tell me afterwards, oh, well, that was actually just a particularly boring exposition-filled episode, and usually they're better than that. And they said that every time. So I thought, well, I guess I really shouldn't check it out. And then when it ended so poorly, and everybody was like, man, fuck Game of Thrones. That just ruined the previous 8 seasons with this shitty, rushed ending. Then I was kind of glad I didn't waste my time. But this really ties into this thing that we have where, oh, here's a successful entertainment property. We can't just tell one story. Now we have to go back and tell every possible tertiary story that exists on the fringes of this. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it works when we get things like Star Wars, where we're going to tell the story of how they actually got the Death Star plans in Rogue One. We're going to tell the story of Cassian Andor in this series is very well done. We got Boba Fett, who's a very popular character. We'll tell his story. These things work, but then you get things like Madame Web, where, hey, hope you guys want to watch a story about Uncle Ben's coworker's bad day, and we can't mention Spider-Man. So this idea of we have this universe and we gotta exploit every single possible narrative within that universe in order to squeeze every penny we can out of the entertainment going public. I just don't. I mean, who was asking for a Jon Snow series? I mean, he was all over the original Game of Thrones, from what I understand. Do we actually need to have? Oh, here's what he was doing on that Thursday when the cameras were pointed at Sophie Turner. Do we need that? I mean, is that something that we need? Is it
There
necessary?
is some storytelling element that can take place in the Jon Snow aspect after what the events of season 8 of Game of Thrones. Like, there's definitely storytelling material that they could mine. They'd be making it all up from whole cloth because George R. R. Martin hasn't even gotten that far yet. So, and he may never get that far. Shit, I've been waiting on this last book of his for like a dozen years now, it seems. But
Yeah.
I don't know. Like you said, they're kind of tapping too hard. I mean, what's next? Lord of the Rings, the story of Tom Bombadil, a whole movie about Tom Bombadil.
I'm sure somebody has pitched that, and I'm sure it's been in consideration by somebody at some point. And they probably gave Peter
Maybe
Jackson a call, and he probably expressed interest.
maybe the Amazon
I mean, Lord of the
specialist
Rings is
touch
a good
on it.
example. Again, like Lord of the Rings, those movies are great, but when you've got, oh, we're going to take The Hobbit and we're going to make this. I mean, at least when they did the Lord of the Rings movies, we were talking about a trilogy of books. When they do The Hobbit, we got to make that a trilogy too, even though it was only one book. And we're going to put in all these other characters. Legolas wasn't in The Hobbit, but he was in the movie because people liked Orlando Bloom's portrayal of that character. So
Right.
it strikes me as being cynical. I mean, obviously, art and commerce have always had a really uneasy relationship. But at the same time, it's pretty obvious when somebody makes a movie because they have a passion for making that movie and telling that story. And it's also pretty obvious when people are have a passion for making money, and that's why they're making the movie.
Cash grab. Speaking of movies that seem to have hit on kind of a flat note, last kind of little piece of news that we're going to bring to you today is they just released the trailer for Joker, the second movie in the Joker series. What was it called?
Voilà, adieu.
I don't speak French. I don't know what that means.
I don't either. I probably pronounced it wrong.
Part two, something like that. I don't know. Whatever. Joker Part Two. The follow-up to Joker with Joaquin Phoenix and now Lady Gaga stepping into the role of Harleen Quinzel. Now, look, I've been eagerly anticipating this trailer. I really loved the first movie. Again, we talk about being subversive and dark and a twisted take on things. And I thought what they did with the character of Joker in a Batman-less world was kind of interesting, kind of neat. Would it work for every character? Absolutely not. But I thought it kind of worked. It helped resonate and ground the Joker a bit more than a superhero kind of tights and flights would have done. That being said, I watched this trailer. Have you watched the trailer yet?
I did watch the trailer, yeah.
Remember we talked about that feeling of who the hell was this made for? That's kind of what I get from this. Like, we talked about that in regards to like the Penguin series coming out from Matt Reeves' Batman.
And who was asking for this?
Ironically, also a Batman property, but let's not tie that too close together. But
it's a Batman property that's in the Matt Reeves Bat universe, which is different from the one that that Arthur Fleck is in, and that is also distinct from the DCEU, which is now being rebooted as a DCU. So it's, you know, you can talk all day about how the MCU is sprawling, but at least it's all connected. I mean, sure, we've got certain things like the Netflix street level universe with Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and all that, the Defenders being separate, or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and stuff. But, you know, for the most part, the MCU is largely united. But we've essentially got, in the last 15 years, four different DC universes that are all sort of competing for attention. And we don't know where to look.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks like it's well acted. I'm probably going to watch it probably opening weekend. I mean, I love Joaquin Phoenix's take on the character. But again, we're in a Batman-less world. Bruce Wayne was, what, 12 in the first movie?
Yeah.
Like, his parents weren't even dead yet. He wasn't even on his path. So really, I don't know what this take is going to bring. I'm going to go into it open-mindedly, hopefully. And, I mean, I've heard it's a musical. They're calling it a jukebox musical.
Oh, Christ, I hate those. I genuinely fucking hate those. Because if you want to talk about, like, a cynical cash grab, if you're going to do a musical, if you're going to do, like an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, or, like, a classic Hollywood musical based on something from Broadway, you know, Sondheim, if you're going to do something like that, then you're creating original music for this film. The jukebox musicals, even the one that was the Queen jukebox musical, We Will Rock You, I fucking hate these. Wasn't a fan of Mamma Mia, wasn't a fan of Jersey Boys. It just seems like, hey, I absolutely wasn't a fan of Rock of Ages. That one was the worst of the bunch, because at least we've got a focus of Mamma Mia. It's ABBA. We've got a focus with the Steppin' Out, the Billy Joel musical, where you sort of like take this body of work, this oeuvre from this given artist, and like retroactively reverse engineer a story out of it and then sprinkle in the songs. People are fans of these musicians, that's fine. But like Rock of Ages, it's like, hey, nostalgia, people like 80s music, let's make a musical and just put all these already existing songs into it. You're fucking cheating. It really is copying off somebody else's paper. And it pisses me off. It's so cynical. It's so uninspired. It, you know, to that end, I also didn't care for Moulin Rouge, you know, because it was using existing music. It's one thing to have, like, to take a classic story and bring it into the modern day, like Baz Luhrmann did with the Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio, Romeo and Juliet. That's the Bard is timeless. I saw a production once of Midsummer Night's Dream that was set in like an inner city setting, and Puck was a gospel singing black woman, and I thought it was fucking brilliant. It was the Pyramus and Thisbe subplay, they were whispering through a chain link fence. Brilliant. You can do that. I've seen a Henry VIII that was set in Nazi Germany. These are great. These are good ideas. You can take classic stories and update them for now. What rankles is when you try to take a classic story and inject modern elements into it the other direction. Like if you've got like a Knight's Tale, where you've got like Queen and David Bowie in this like sort of medieval courtyard setting, or whether you've got, you know, Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor, and it wasn't Ewan McGregor, it was James McAvoy, I get my Scottish actors mixed up, singing I Will Always Love You on top of an elephant. It doesn't work. I mean, again, I can't really speak for other people. It was obviously a very popular movie. I didn't care for it because it just seemed like a really ill fit to do something like that. But yeah.
You should talk about Moulin Rouge, musicals. Right?
What's that?
It was Ewan McGregor in Moulin Rouge.
I think it was... Was it Ewan McGregor or was it James McAvoy?
Ewan McGregor.
Hello there.
Okay, see.
Obi-Wan Kenobi. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I only watched about the first half hour of it, which is why I don't remember. I actually got up and walked out of the theater when James Broadbent started singing Like a Virgin. I was like, fuck it, dip, I'm out. I tapped out. I couldn't do it. Because I'm just like, I kept waiting for it to get good, and then it just never did. And I just found myself actually watching it, sitting there feeling proxy embarrassment for everybody involved with this absolute fucking turd of a movie. But again, a lot of people liked it, so we're not here to yuck anybody's yum on the fandom front. So I really should shut my fucking mouth.
Before we get to the topic here, I just want to mention, and I know I mentioned this to you before, the X-Men 97 cartoon. We've talked about, you know, Beau DeMeo getting fired from that cartoon and everything like that.
Yeah.
They just aired episode 5 as we sit and record today. a couple days ago, and I'm not going to spoil it. I will not do that.
I'm going to be checking it out.
The episode is titled "Remember It," and holy shit, it was such a gut punch. And I was looking at some follow-up articles after watching, and believe me when I say, stay the fuck off the internet. Don't go looking for news about this show, or even entertainment news might spoil it for you. It's that rife for spoilers, but reading some of the stuff that Bo DeMeo has to say about it, people are like, holy shit, episode 5, Bo, that must have been your masterwork. That must have been your big piece for this season. He's like, no. Episodes 8, 9, and 10 are the big piece for the season.
Wow.
Which just indicates that it's going to get just more holy shit than this. And this episode fucking floored me. I watched it 3 times. It floored me. So I'm not going to spoil it. I won't say anything other than if you're not watching X-Men 97, you're missing out. Especially if you've got a soft place in your heart for the old X-Men animated cartoon. It is a perfect homage to that original cartoon. And get off your ass. Get your Disney account fired up and watch it. I mean it.
I'm gonna.
However, that all being said, of course, we have to remind you before we start the topic that the podcast is never intended to be a one-way conduit of conversation. Jim and I like, require, and request your input. And there's a couple different ways that you can do that. You can hit us up on Facebook, facebook.com/fuelyourfandom. Always drop us a line at fuelyourfandom@gmail.com.
You can also hit us up at fyftalentbooking@gmail.com. That is our backup email address. You can find us on Threads and Instagram at @fuelyourfandom. You can also dig us up anywhere you find fine podcasts, such as Audible or Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I mean, I have to sit here and think about it because so many of these podcast platforms are going down, you know, like crazy. So we have to try and stay on top of that. But any place you get your podcasts, you can find us there. Any place you find us, we're happy you do. And of course, if you can't wait, like I tend to get impatient, you can always find us bright and early every Friday morning at fuelyourfandom.buzzsprout.com, where my boy Saint gets every fresh, wet, and screaming episode slapped up for your listening, leisurely enjoyment every Friday morning. So, get us in your ear holes. We like it in there. It's nice.
Sure. Absolutely. Now, Jim, I made mention at the top of the hour here that we have our first guest of the season here.
We certainly do.
Your Fandom Podcast. I'm pretty excited.
I am as well.
Introduced us, so I'm going to let you introduce her to the public at large. Why don't you go ahead and do that?
I shall. Our guest today is a person I've known for a very long time. Her name is Katie Cadaver. She is a native of the Milwaukee area. We've been traveling in the same circles for quite a while. She is a body positive cosplayer, a makeup artist, and is also a performer and founder with Grindhouse Tees, which is a horror burlesque troupe in Cream City, and a collaborative of many, many artists up there who work together to put on these fantastic shows. She's also a traumette. So she hangs out with Trauma Entertainment, which you may know from the Toxic Avenger. And so she's rubbing elbows with Lloyd Kaufman quite a bit at these cons and representing that company. She is also the co-host of the VHS Vault, which is a podcast that explores the amazingly terrible cult classic horror films and B-movies that time forgot. Katie is Milwaukee's horror hottie. She puts the gore in gorgeous, and she is here with us today on the Feel Your Fandom podcast to talk about not just horror burlesque, not just horrible old VHS horror movies, but also just the nature of fandom in general. And we could not be more pleased she's here with us. Welcome to the podcast, Ms. Katie Cadaver.
Hey guys, that was an amazing intro. I feel like I need an air horn or something behind that. Yep, perfect. I feel properly welcomed. So thank you.
Absolutely. Well, welcome. We We're glad to see you. We're glad to have you here. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. It's fun to sort of watch how the sausage is made, I guess.
Ew, gross.
I listen to you guys, you know, once everything's been edited and put out to the public, but being able to kind of stick around and see behind the scenes has been fun for me.
No sound effects yet. I have to go through and edit all those in and...
I mean, there were some sound effects. If you don't edit out my stomach gurgling from this crappy medication, you'll definitely hear something.
Well, that's different. I gotta go to YouTube and find an actual gurgling sound effect and put it over you. But
I look forward to the finished product as well.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Now, we talk a lot about... We kind of had a conversation yesterday before we were talking. We were just getting ready for the show today, and... We talked a lot about nostalgia as it revolves around fandom, and nostalgia is a thing that you're big into. Why don't you give us kind of your take on it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I noticed that you guys sort of have a little bit of a blind spot in your fandom for horror stuff in general.
That's true.
But I think like where we sort of come together is around the idea of nostalgia. I'm one of those people who really doesn't consume a lot of current stuff, movies, music, like music a little bit more. But if it's new movies and things, like I'll get to it for sure, maybe when it comes on streaming, but like, I don't know, I'll probably check in about 20 years and like really jump in. Like, that's kind of what I like to do, is go backwards and discover all of the things that I was either too young to appreciate at the time that they were popular, or I wasn't born yet, or whatever. Just things from the past, mostly movies and music, because the beautiful thing is it's always there for me, just waiting for me to discover it. I didn't have to, you know, be dancing in clubs to new wave music in the 80s, but I get to do that today because it's still there and available to me. So I love to go back and explore the past.
Oh, absolutely. And that's kind of, and that's what we talked about yesterday, the fact that that's pretty much the bread and butter of what fandom truly is. I mean, because you could be a fan of the new and bright and shiny, but like, I think the true roots of fandom are things like you find like your Star Trek fans go way back to like 67, 66, and look at the original Star Trek as a role model, as a blueprint for their fandom. You look at the Star Wars fan base, and of course you're going to have the majority of those people go back to 77, 1980, 1983 as the birth and foundation of that fandom. The birth and foundation of fandom is always rooted in the past. Even like Marvel Comics fandom, which is popular now because of the MCU, has its roots in like the 50s and 60s and 70s, and in these early cult comics created by, you know, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee and the like, Chris Claremont and all them.
Steve Ditko.
So, yeah, I forget Ditko and Romita, all of them. But, I mean, it all firmly has its roots in the past, in nostalgia. And that's, I think that's kind of where fandom and nostalgia have this wonderful meetup point, is that you can't have one really without the other.
Right. I think most of us are nostalgic for, I don't know, things from our childhood specifically. Like, I've noticed, you know, the millennials, the Gen Xers kind of tend to be nostalgic for our 80s and 90s, you know, childhood and coming of age periods. And a lot of that, I think, fuels my interest, particularly when it comes to horror movies. As a kid, they scared the shit out of me. I was definitely afraid. I was not one of these kids who was like, yeah, I was watching horror movies at like 7, 8 years old. I definitely was exposed to the pop culture of like Freddy Krueger as a young kid, but I was really afraid of it. So being able to come back and revisit it as an adult with a different perspective it's nostalgic for me, and it's fun. And I don't know, there's just something about revisiting stuff from your past and seeing it in a new way that can be interesting. And I tend to do that with movies in general over the years. My all-time favorite movie, The Blues Brothers, that was playing here at the Avalon earlier this week. And every time I watch that movie, it hits just a little bit differently depending on where I'm at, how I'm feeling, whatever's going on in my life at the time. It's a favorite of mine. It's something I can always return to, but I just love that every time I watch it, I feel a little bit different.
I was going to say, you mentioned that, you know, looking at, like, for instance, like horror movies, going back and looking at horror movies through a different set of lenses. You're absolutely right. Because, like, growing up, things like Child's Play or the Freddy Krueger movies or things like that, like you said, scared the shit out of me. I was too young for it. I was maybe ill-prepared for what it was. But going back now to the mindset of a, you know, 30s and 40s or whatever year old person, I'm able to see it for the camp that it is. And you put that camp filter mm-hmm. over it, and all of a sudden, it just it looks different. It acts different.
It takes on a whole new life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's actually really leaning into what I love about horror movies. I love the camp. I love the ridiculousness. I don't actually want to be traumatized. I'm not a horror fan that wants to be traumatized. Like, I don't want to walk away from a movie feeling bad. You know, I want to have
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, Eli Roth.
Yeah. And I'm not
I was
going to
get to that.
He's a great director, but it's not my cup of tea. My favorite horror movie is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. If you haven't seen Part 2, you're really missing out because it's directed by the same person, Tobe Hooper, who directed the first one, but he went the complete opposite direction because he knew he could never recreate the masterpiece of the first film. So he took it in a completely different direction, and it includes pretty much everything I love about horror movies. It's schlocky, it's campy, it's funny, it's dark, it's gory. It's great.
I think that's why I like the Sam Raimi Evil Dead movies, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
The same kind of thing. Like, they realized that they were going to be able to do much more for Evil Dead 2, so they just kind of reinterpreted the first one and did it again. And so...
yeah, you just brought up Eli Roth. That's interesting. I wanted to kind of, you said that we have kind of a blind spot when it comes to horror, and I do not disagree with you. We do. And a large part of that is because one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today is because of the vintage horror thing. Now, I used to watch a lot of horror movies when I was younger. I really got into the character-driven horror movies. I really liked, you know, Phantasm with the Tall Man. I liked Leatherface. I liked Freddy Krueger. I liked Jason Voorhees. I liked, you know, Pinhead. I liked all of these character-driven, antagonist-driven movies. But then at one point, I think the how we think about horror and how Hollywood made horror movies changed. And there was, I think, a distinct gulf between, like, the Blair Witch Project, which was, I think, one of the last movies that I really went to go see that could be really contextualized as a horror movie, where you never really see the monster. It's more like the dread and the threat. Like, you're reaching for a light switch in a dark room, and a cold hand moves over yours, moves it to the switch, you turn on the light, and the hand is gone. That kind of creeping dread I kind of liked. But then Eli Roth came along, and it became gore porn, in a way, and it was just gross. And I looked at it, and I was like, this is not for me anymore. And I kind of walked away from horror. So I kind of want to make
your take
on...
They're remaking that, by the way. You know that, right?
No, thank you.
They just announced that... No, Blair Witch. They just announced that Blumhouse is remaking the Blair Witch Project.
Why would you do that? You can't... You just, you know, it's like trying to remake The Sixth Sense. The novelty is gone. Like, there are a lot of people... I draw a direct line between Blair Witch and War of the Worlds, because War of the Worlds was a radio play, but if you missed the introduction and you just tuned in and heard that there were aliens, you know, being landing all over the place, being invaded, there was a panic about that. A lot of people really thought that Blair Witch was a found footage project. They didn't understand that it was a conceit, and that's just a vehicle they used to tell the story. So I wanted to kind of get your take, Katie, on what you think about, like, vintage horror versus modern horror, and what the reasons are by why you focus your fandom more on the classic stuff more so than the new stuff, and if that sort of, like, shift in tone had anything to do with it.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head when you said there was the more character-driven horror, the slashers specifically, and it kind of got away from that. 90s was kind of when that started to switch. There's some great horror movies made in the 90s, but I really focus my fandom on late 70s and pretty much all the way through the 80s. Practical effects are a big reason for that. When computer effects got more popular, I mean, you can do pretty much anything you want at this point and make it look like anything super realistic. That doesn't blow my skirt up. I really like the practical effects, the shit you had to make in your kitchen and figure it out. There's these Italian directors, particularly Joe D'Amato, directed one of my favorite films called Buio Omega. That's the Italian title. And I'm not even going to tell you the English title because have fun looking up Booyah Omega. Anyway, he used pig guts and like real animal guts from like a butcher shop to get these effects, and just the camera angles and the way that these scenes were shot and all of that kind of stuff. Like, you can just do all that with a computer now, and it sort of takes the excitement out of it for me. I really love to see the artistry of practical effects. It's something that inspires me in my own creative work. And just to see, like, even if it wasn't done that well, some of the shit that they were able to pull off in the 80s, like, it's amusing to me. I'm not amused by, you know, computer generated effects in newer movies. Like, it just doesn't do anything for me. And two, like I said, I don't want to be traumatized. Like, some of these newer movies they're really good, right? They really can paint a picture for you and all that stuff in terms of it being a well-made film. That's great. But again, what pulls my interest is not always super well-made realistic films. You know, I actually like the schlock. I like the, you know, redneck zombies shot on VHS zombie movie where they had, you know, one paid for prop in the whole film, you know, things like that draw my attention, I think, more. And I do like the classic slashers, you know, like the Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, you know, all of that kind of stuff, Hellraiser. Those movies are great. And I think that was sort of the heyday of horror filmmaking, in my perspective. There's a different wave of it coming around now, and I can just tell you, I'm not super motivated to see those films. Most of the Blumhouse stuff, I haven't seen it. You know, I'm just not that motivated with newer stuff because there's so many older films to explore. I mean, I could rattle off a bunch of titles that you probably never heard of, but like, one of my favorite things to do is like sit down and, you know, pay whatever it is, $6.99 a month for a Shudder, and watch Joe Bob Briggs and how he goes through all these old movies that people have forgotten about and, you know, sort of brings these old films back to life. And he makes fun of them, you know, which is great. He'll have guests on that, you know, actors that were on the movie. Like, that's sort of really in the vein of horror convention fandom. Like, I don't know, horror fans, we're nerds like y'all, just in a little bit different way. And some of these older movies that they might not have been shit 30 years ago, but they have this resurgence now with some of us cult horror fans. And I don't know, that's just more interesting to me than whatever they're doing now. And I can't quite pinpoint why specifically, but I think it just leans into my sensibilities and what I like. Old is new for me. I don't know.
Well, I would think that maybe it might have something to do with the fact that what we talked about earlier about making a movie for money versus making it for passion. If you're looking at like making a movie, because right now horror movies are doing really well because they can be made on shoestring budgets and they tend to pull in a lot of money. So there's only really two kinds of movies that are hitting the cinema right now. There's your big superhero blockbustery kind of things, and then there's your horror movies. Anything else is not a guarantee that it's going to make any kind of money. And even though the superhero movies don't necessarily anymore. But if you're making a horror movie because they make money, that's going to show. Versus, hey, this is a scrappy guy who has an idea, an affinity for this stuff, and he's out there sourcing pig guts. Nobody wants to do that. But like, if you're doing that, then that's, I think, indicative of a level of interest in the genre, of passion for the actual method of storytelling that you're just not going to get with somebody who's like, okay, we can just CGI in the blood later.
Yeah, yeah. I read, going up through college, when I was studying filmmaking, one of the books that I actually ended up reading was by Bruce Campbell, ironically enough. It was called If Chins Could Kill. I think it's what it was called, If Chins Could Kill. But it's like a semi-autobiographical book where he's talking about the making of the original Evil Dead movie. And they talk about just being like these six kids who just went into the woods with a car and a camera and like gallons of Karo syrup and food coloring and... Yep. Yeah. They talk about how they did all the bloody scenes, and if they did too many scenes at once, his shirt would freeze from all the sugar in the syrup, and he'd have to, like, you could, like, snap his shirt in half. I mean, just, and reading about all the ways that they had to create these camera effects that didn't exist back then, that's kind of what fascinated me about the original, like, Star Wars trilogy, too, is because they had to sit there and create things didn't exist for how they wanted to shoot this. They couldn't say, you know, oh, we're going to do matte painting here. We're going to go in through CGI and do this here. It didn't exist. They had to figure this out. It's like, well, we're like Sam Raimi. He built like this wheelchair dolly, camera guy sitting in a wheelchair, push in towards the window, camera on a greased up rail, sliding down this rail in through the window. The window breaks as it goes through the window, and it worked. And it worked because it was practical. And sure, today's value might call it schlocky and everything, but I think you're absolutely right. There's something more visceral about hands-on approach like that. I just want to make sure.
And it speaks to the art that I do. You know, I do horror burlesque, so I'm doing practical effects on stage. This is the kind of shit they were trying to figure out 30, 40 years ago, and they were making these movies and they didn't have all this technology to do it. And I don't have that technology either. And I have a little side story that is sort of relevant. When I was at Horror Hound just a few weeks back, I was working with Lloyd Kaufman, who was making an appearance, and Sam Raimi was also at the same convention. And he actually put in a request to meet Lloyd. He wanted Lloyd to come over and meet him at his table. And so Lloyd doesn't go anywhere without his entourage of citizens of Tromaville. So we all gathered together and I got to stand there and meet Sam Raimi and to watch him geek out over Lloyd Kaufman. Lloyd Kaufman's been making these schlocky movies for 50 years and doing this stuff. And Sam Raimi is fanboying over Lloyd Kaufman and what he does with his trauma films. And it just, I don't know. It just showed me something there, like, you know, Sam Raimi being as successful a director as he is, and he still looks up to somebody like Lloyd Kaufman, who will stand on the convention floor for 8 hours on a Saturday, never take a break, never sit down, signing autographs for free when you have celebrities from the last, you know, Walking Dead or Terrifier movie charging 40, 50 bucks for their signature. Lloyd will stand there and sign for free and take pictures for free. And this guy's been making movies and making them with his bare hands for 50 years. You know, there's just something about that passion for me that I'm drawn to that. And it showed me, you know, that Sam Raimi's drawn to that too. You know, he's inspired by Lloyd Kaufman. And I don't know, I think that's pretty cool.
That is very much so.
That is cool. Are there any filmmakers today doing kind of, and I know you said you don't really rock to the Blumhouse type of horror movie convention. And me and Jim, we talked about the fact that a large part of the reason that the Blumhouse is as successful as they are is because they have a business model where they're not doing like the $200-300 million tentpole summer blockbuster type thing that is now failing Marvel and failing DC. But what they're doing is they're throwing like, okay, we'll throw $100,000 at 10 different people. And maybe 8 or 9 of those things will fail and they'll be out, you know, $900,000, but they'll have the one thing that hits that goes for $2-3 million, pays for all of that, subsidizes all of that, rinse, repeat. Very much in the same vein that I also, one of the other books I read in film school was Robert Rodriguez's Rebel Without a Crew. Talks about how he went on and how he went to learn to make movies by making El Mariachi. And he made El Mariachi by, the basic idea was he was going to learn by doing it. He was going to learn, make this movie on a shoestring budget, release it on the straight-to-VHS Mexican film market, use whatever funds he gathered and whatever experience he gathered, move into the next project, and then up and up and up and up and up. But it just so happened that it caught wind at Miramax and took off from there. But the whole idea was to learn through doing. And I kind of, I feel like you're right. We have a lot of people that are focused on spectacle now when they're not really focused on the craft.
Yep.
Are there any modern directors out there that you think are doing it right? Is there any kind of horror that's coming out?
Not any names that you would recognize, right? It's a ton of independent filmmakers out here doing the thing, boots on the ground all the time, movies being shot left and right all over the country. The independent filmmakers are out here doing, you know, all of that still. But, you know, they're not getting the attention put on them because that's
the
not what
distribution and everything. Yeah, like yeah.
Yeah, that's it, there's no money to be made in it. It's just like making a podcast, you know. You're in the red most of the time on a podcast, right? There's not a ton of money coming back, but you do it cuz you love it. You know, same right. thing with being in a band or doing burlesque. Like I'm never ahead monetarily for burlesque. You know, I'm always in the hole. And these independent filmmakers are kind of in the same boat, but they're doing it because they love it. And the rest of us that love it support what they're doing. And, you know, it sustains itself enough that they can make the next movie on the $5,000 budget and, you know, put it out there. Like, yeah, there's tons of independent horror movies that you can stream on, well, Troma Now, of course, or even on Amazon Prime. They're all over the place. So I always say just like look into what the little guy is doing, because I think that's really where that passion still is. And a lot of those themes that most of us love from the 70s and 80s, they're coming back in these independent movies that never see the light of day because, you know, there's not big bucks to be made in them. But, you know, if you like schlock, if you don't take yourself too seriously and you're movie watching too seriously, there's a lot of great stuff out here.
I agree. Jim, you keep looking like you had something to say. I felt like I was stepping on you.
Well, no, I just, one of the reasons why I wanted to have Katie on the podcast is because, you know, what she said, she's right. I definitely have a real blind spot with this because I kind of, at one point, just walked away from horror because I felt this sea change away from like these narrative-driven, character-driven things that I used to like. And then they kind of, you know, move them into a new realm of like, we're just going to go for absolute gross out, you know, buckets of blood, guts flying at the screen, and it's all CGI and it's all very cynical. But I think there's, you know, like even in some mainstream cinema, like I've been, I walked away from horror a while ago, but I sort of have been dipping a toe in a little bit. And again, this is in no way contemporary. We're talking maybe, you know, five, six, even, I don't know, time frames are crazy as I get older and time speeds up, but like the A Quiet Place movie appealed to me. And I did see that for the same reason that like some of this M. Night Shyamalan stuff, you know, still appeals to me, that may not be straight horror, but sort of, you know, dances around that that camp where it's more of a like a monster driven thriller where you might not necessarily see the monster like in Signs, or whether it's A Quiet Place, where they sort of like they you see like flashes of it running by the camera or something. You just know what you can't do. You can't make any noise, you know, otherwise it's going to hear you. It's hunting. Its predatory streak is based on auditory processing. But it's a really strange thing, I think, to think that most people who are maybe not horror fans, they look at horror and think, well, it's just a horror movie, because it always kind of existed in this little kind of segregated area off on its own, because it's cheap and it's tawdry and it's gross. And it's kind of like analogous to porn in a way, where it's got dedicated theaters and the floors are sticky and you go and it's like, you know, it's these things are made on a shoestring budget for a very niche audience. But there are some things that kind of crack through into the mainstream that people, even who maybe aren't necessarily horror fans or aren't horror fans anymore, can't really, you know, help but pay attention to. And sometimes I gamble and lose. Like I saw Evil Dead Rise in the theater a little while ago. And you know, I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it, but it was just, it definitely, it came to my attention early on in that movie that this isn't going to be very character driven. It's not going to be very narrative driven. This is just about jump scares and shock and gore and literal buckets of blood splashing all over the screen. And I'm not going to call it boring. I'm not going to say that's boring, because it definitely does. It's visceral. It grabs and holds your attention. But I so prefer, like the Hellraiser remake that just came out maybe a couple of years ago. I did watch that, and that was a lot more enjoyable, because it kind of felt like we were getting back to the narrative slash character driven sort of horror. And that, I think, is the kind of thing that I'd like to see more of. And even though I don't have a bias against horror, I sort of like made the decision that it wasn't for me a while ago, but occasionally I do crack through and see certain things. Like the Blumhouse stuff, a lot of what Jordan Peele is doing, I'm hearing really good things about. And I haven't seen any of those. And when I say any, I haven't seen Us. I haven't seen Get Out. I haven't seen Nope. I haven't seen any of those. But I definitely at least have an interest in seeing those, because they look more interesting to me. They look more like We're gonna hide the monster for a little while. We're gonna like it's gonna be this like building, creeping dread, this crescendo of like that leads to a payoff, as opposed to like in the first 5 minutes we're tossing CGI blood at the screen. So I guess what I'm wondering is the point that I'm like I never ramble or on about anything, but the point that I'm trying to build to is like, how do you sort of like look at categorizing these things? How do you break these things down? In a classic or a modern sense of like the subgenres of horror and what that sort of means in terms of people that might be looking for like a specific kind of horror movie.
So, Jim, I gotta ask you, have you ever seen a giallo? Does that
No.
word mean anything to you?
No.
Giallo. It's yellow in Italian, and it's a whole genre of film that I think you might actually be into if you were able to give them a shot. There's a whole reason they're called giallos, having to do with like these yellow covers on the books, but they're like mysteries, basically, turned
Okay.
into horror movies, mostly popular in like 60s and 70s, a little bit in the 80s. Dario Argento is one of the more well-known giallo directors. And those films are there's a really good story, usually a really good mystery to try to figure out, really great imagery in these films. And then the effects are they're okay, right? Because these are older movies, but like the kills are sometimes like the most badass kills you can imagine seeing in a horror movie. That's something that sort of excites me too, is like creative fun kills. And one of the most fun giallos is called Deep Red, or Deep Red by Dario Argento. He directed that as well as many other ones, but Deep Red has a lot of really fun kills and a really cool reveal of who the killer is at the end. And so you get this like mystery, but it's also a horror movie. And then the music is also really amazing. Goblin, I'm not sure if you're familiar, the prog rock, Italian prog rock band, very popular in the 70s. They did scores for many Italian films during that time. Some American films like George Romero has used Goblin as well. But you get awesome music, really pretty scenes and imagery, cool kills, and then like a fun storyline. You can't go wrong. But again, these are movies that came out, 40 plus years ago.
Sure.
So for a modern audience, I don't know. But for us horror nerds, like giallo is a whole subgenre of horror movies that a lot of people are really into, myself included. And then, of course, you have slashers, and you kind of know what to expect with your slashers and your psychological horror movies and stuff like that. There's a lot of different categories, and for somebody like you who's sort of got pulled away for some of the reasons that you mentioned, like I think going backwards is really in your best interest when it comes to horror. Like, it's the foundation for all of these films that are coming out now. Like, the reason why Jordan Peele can make a good movie, because the foundation of horror that came before is so robust that he has a lot to draw from, and then he spins it in his own way and makes, a really relevant, interesting horror film. Like, I think the same thing was happening 20, 30, 40 years ago as well with other directors. But just like time period specific, and exploring Italian horror specifically is like it's fun to do. I recommend that people try it if you're not too grossed out by the practical effects. Like, I don't know, there's a lot of like every like Lucio Fulci movie has like somebody getting stabbed in the eyeball, which makes for cool visuals,
Yeah.
but like some people
That's
are
one
like
of
grossed out by it.
Jim's
Now,
pet peeves.
some people, eye horror is a thing for me. Like all that Unchained Andalou kind of stuff. That just, eye horror is, I think it's because as a kid, I wore glasses for many, many years, not because I had anything wrong with my actual lenses, but I had a lazy eye and I had to wear corrective lenses. And at 2 years old, I had them putting belladonna eye drops in my eyes to dilate them, and I did burned. And so to this day, I can't even put in fucking Visine. I get really touchy about eye stuff.
Oh,
So
so
yeah, anytime
perfect.
anybody's any well, anytime you get an eye getting sliced open or gouged out, I'm yep, that's it. I gotta go. That's one area where I gotta tap out.
Just
Just
have a
squidges
few
out easy.
scenes to gross you out if I ever need to do that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be explored. That's what I mean. It's like, yeah,
yeah.
The current push of horror movies has gone in a different direction, but that's the beauty of having this back catalog that you'll never watch everything. I mean, there's so yeah. much. And that's what I love about going backwards. It's like, if what's currently going on isn't blowing my skirt up, I got a million things I can go towards from the past. And I feel the same way about music. Like, one of the controversial opinions that I hold at this time is that I'm really like into Dio era Sabbath, like a lot more than Ozzy era Sabbath. And like, I know it's sacrilege to say this, but like, you know, when I was younger, it was all about Ozzy. And then as I've grown up and matured, like I realized like the Dio stuff actually hits for me a lot better right now. So, you know, I think the same can be true with movies. Like, you just have to be willing to explore some of that old sure. stuff that you maybe would have passed on, you know, 20 years ago based on who you were then. But maybe your sensibilities have changed a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, my sensibilities toward horror movies definitely changed. And I definitely can pinpoint the tipping point of that, like with the Eli Roth era, the sort of gore porn stuff coming in. But I mean, yeah, that makes total sense. Like, well, if there was a certain historical tipping point where everything that came after that kind of you wrinkle up your nose at, then it makes sense to go in the opposite direction. And yeah. that really is kind of the focus, I think, of, you know, of VHS Vault. Now, you are, as I mentioned earlier, the co-host of VHS Vault, and your co-host, you talk about classic horror in a way that is kind of part review, part homage, and just all geeky fandom, which is like just dovetails exactly with the kind of stuff that we do.
Right.
So I guess then my question for you would also be, because you are so well versed in this stuff, you already mentioned that Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is your all-time favorite horror movie. And again, I know this is kind of like it's for somebody who's so well versed in the subject as you, like a really, really difficult question to answer. But like for somebody like me, if I came to you and said, "Hey, Katie, I don't know anything about classic horror movies. What are the five movies you could recommend for somebody who's a total novice or just not as well versed as you are that would kind of offer a little something for everyone, something that would be like a good range of movies that I could watch that would give me at least a working base of education to build from if I wanted to continue to explore going forward? What's like your Mount Rushmore, your top five, let's just say, of kind of vintage horror films?"
So I'll say for myself, I don't go back to the classic like Universal Monsters stuff as much as I should. But I feel like you got to do at least one. You got to start, whether it's, you know, Bela Lugosi's Dracula or like Frankenstein's Monster, something from the classic, you know, take your pick, whatever. There's a million. I think it's just good to go back that far and see like, where did this stuff kind of begin? And
roots.
Some of this, yeah, the roots of the filmmaking and the styles and stuff like that. But then I also think like Night of the Living Dead is a classic must watch for anybody that wants to understand even modern horror. Again, a lot of George Romero was doing some amazing things. These directors who have made a name for themselves and are basically like the godfathers of horror. A lot of the stuff that they did in the beginning, like Tobe Hooper, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was like a college film. You know, these are guys that they started young doing this stuff. And what they came with, what they brought in the beginning was really influential. When you look at Night of the Living Dead, like there's a black lead in this movie from 1968. Like,
yeah.
And it was not supposed to necessarily be so ahead of its time in that way. It was just, Romero said he was just the best actor for the job. You know, I just gave him the job, but it's really pivotal in the film at the end. The way that it makes the viewer feel typically at the end is, it wouldn't be the same if that actor wasn't black. So I feel like that's a really important film to understand. Also the zombie genre, because that's an important subset of horror sure. films. I have a couple of favorite zombie movies that they're very different, but Return of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead are my two favorite zombie films. And
now, that's the original Dawn of the Dead, not the one that was supposedly set in Milwaukee that got all the details wrong.
Yes. Just from here on out, if it's a remake that I prefer, which is very rare, I'll definitely say that. Like, you know, The Thing is actually a remake. John Carpenter remade it. The John Carpenter version of The Thing is the movie I would be referring to if I said The Thing, right? But yeah, like 80s movies, like you got to have a slasher in there. Because the slasher genre is so important. So like probably Friday the 13th is kind of the quintessential slasher that like probably everybody needs to watch. And then you do need a zombie movie. So I really loved Dawn of the Dead for different reasons than I liked Return of the Living Dead. But I would say if you want to get like sort of that 80s nostalgia and also like a really awesome zombie movie, I got to go Return of the Living Dead. So what have I said? That's probably four movies already, and we're not even out of the '80s yet. But you know,
it was a golden era.
It really was. You know, and I would want to throw probably an Italian film in there. I might throw in Suspiria, not technically a giallo by nerd standards for what
I've
a
heard
giallo.
The name before. I've never
yeah,
seen
Suspiria
it.
Has been recently remade. I want to say like in 2018, Tilda Swinton was in the remake. A good movie, but doesn't touch the original for many reasons. But that's a film that, again, it leans into to some of the more European stuff that stylistically is important in the whole, you know, it, I don't know, the building blocks, I guess, of the horror genre. Sure. I think those Italian films are important. So I would throw, you know, one of the, I'd probably throw Suspiria in there, as a good, so you kind of have building blocks and, you know, the found footage. Well, that's not really my cup of tea too much, but I guess Blair Witch is probably the one, the go-to for that. But I could pick, you know, a movie for every subgenre of horror that's, you know, cool. But for, to kind of get you started, I would have to say picking something from the Universal Monsters, Night of the Living Dead, Return of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead, Friday the 13th, Suspiria. Like, I feel like that's a good place to start. Also, you'd have to throw the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre in there.
Sure.
Because that's a really important film for... The thing that a lot of people don't realize in that movie is that there's no blood in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like, at all.
Yeah.
It's all implied gore. So that's a really amazing piece of filmmaking there, the way that movie scared people. Like, I think it's, again, another building block, you know, to the genre. So that's a hard question to answer. Obviously, I gave you way more than five movies.
Well, no, it's a great, it's a good launching point because, I mean, I'm thinking about things like like when you talked about Texas Chainsaw Massacre as being bloodless, I think about things like how shocking, you know, Psycho was, Alfred Hitchcock, mm-hmm. when you think it's this movie about this crime caper, and then all of a sudden halfway through it turns into this horror movie, and then there's this, you know, shocking getting stabbed through the shower curtain thing with Janet Leigh, and you wind up seeing the blood swirling down the drain, which is really unusual for the 60s. You know, and then even like going as far back, I remember this maybe 5-6 years ago, I saw the original Phantom of the Opera with Lon Chaney. Like back at, there was a film festival presentation of it a couple of towns over from here. And it's just really interesting to see kind of how things have changed, how they've progressed. They had it was so great. They had a live organist, actually. They had an original print of the silent movie. And like the big reveal where she takes the mask off and you see Lon Chaney's homemade and very painful, you know, makeup job that he put on there. And, you know, there are people... You know, that at the time that movie came out, they were passing out in the aisles, and now we go and see something like, you know, Evil Dead, and there's just buckets of blood being thrown at the screen, and that desensitization and that sort of acclimation to this genre kind of happens. But no, that's really valuable because, I mean, it really you what you said, you know, very early on about that being a blind spot is very true. There are just, you know, a lot of areas of film that I just have for some reason or another either gravitated away from or made the conscious decision to stop paying attention to because there were some developments in the genre that just didn't really appeal to me. But, you know, every once in a while, there's a horror movie that kind of breaks into my consciousness and I check it out. And it's kind of a crapshoot to whether or not it's something that winds up, in retrospect, being something I was glad I watched. But, you know, there's definitely, you know, there's gold everywhere. There really is. And I guess that's the lesson
Absolutely.
For me.
Yes.
I'm going to have to look into some of those as well. Again, like same, I'm in the same boat. My experience does not run deep and doesn't go much past like the creature movies, like, you know, Freddy or Jason or Chucky or things like that. So usually that's kind of where I gravitated towards, but I like when it gets subversive. What was my favorite movie? Horror adjacent, I would say. was Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
That totally counts.
That I loved.
Yeah, we count that.
Horror comedy is also that's another genre, another splitter genre unto itself that, but I tend to really enjoy.
I like.
Well, I mean, the reason I love that movie because I love Alan Tudyk and Tyler Labine. They're some of my favorite actors, and just this idea. And I also watched Cabin in the Woods not too long ago. It had been out for a long, long time, and it had been spoiled for me a couple times over. But I did watch it because it was an inventive twist on kind of a classic formula. So it's not like I'm completely devoid of it, but. You know, there are certain areas where I'm just underinformed. And that, more than anything, is why we love having guests on. Because, I mean, you know, you and I can talk all day about you know, metal music or Marvel movies or comic books or video games. But, you know, I had originally said, hey, I'd love to have Katie on the show because this is an area of fandom that we just don't know as much about. And being able to have somebody on that is well-versed in it that can kind of bring us up to speed on it. And also anybody who might be listening who's tired of hearing us talk about the same shit might be interested in hearing... You know, about what somebody who actually is an expert and an aficionado might have to say about this particular area.
Oh, God. I'm by far an expert. I mean, I just like stuff. You know, I have.
Well, I count that.
Yeah. But my particular brand of ADHD and neurodivergence doesn't really allow me to remember things in acute detail. So I have this, you know, working knowledge of horror films and. The names and the titles and the years that I can remember from having talked about these things until I'm blue in the face. But, you know, it's really just, I think for me about discovering stuff that I like, you know, I needed people to show me things too. You know, I had a huge blind spot for a lot of the older horror because my media consumption sort of looked like, you know, I went and saw movies when they came out in the theater and like, you know, maybe by the time they went to budget, you know, I'd still maybe see them at the budget theater or something, but like I was on top of it. And then if I missed the boat, it was kind of like, well, I missed it. And I guess if it comes on TV, I'll watch it. And I mean, that's just, that wasn't doing me any favors for discovering things that, you know, I had just missed for whatever reason. And when you meet people who are doing that or who are into things a little bit deeper and they start to show you things because they kind of know your personality a little bit and oh, I think you might like this. Oh, you liked that movie, you know, whatever. The algorithm does that for us now on like Letterboxd or whatever, or yeah. IMDb. But like, you know, when friends do it, it's kind of a fun experience. And then it's also a way to share, I don't know, just sort of share in the fandom a little bit. Like there's no replacement for a friend or a loved one sitting you down and saying, you need to watch this movie. And you sit down and you watch it and you have a reaction to it, whether that's, you know, just that you fall in love with it or that you're super grossed out or whatever, it makes you feel something. I don't know. That's a bonding experience with that person. And then, I don't know, we've been doing that our whole lives, I'm sure, with friends. Like, that's kind of how it used to look before we were all in our houses and only talked to each other on the computer. But, you know, I like this idea of exposing people to things that they might not otherwise have a reason to see. Like, yeah. You would probably not have on the list of to watch the movie Street Trash. But if I tell you about it, and I bring it over and, you know, we sit down and we watch this awesome film that I think is great, which is, you know, probably one of the more trashier films from the 80s with the bright colors and the, you know, it's like, you don't even know what I'm talking about, but you might sit down and watch it and love it. And that's the cool thing about, you know, meeting other nerds who are into other things. Like one of these days, somebody's going to get me to sit down and watch Lord of the Rings, the whole trilogy or whatever. It's not going to be today, but you know,
it's going to be a long day. It'll be a long day.
Well, you may say you're not an expert, but then you turn around and you give us some vital information like that and prove it. And then even if you hadn't, like if you're somebody who puts on, you know, zombie makeup and goes to a horror convention and hangs out with Lloyd Kaufman and Sam Raimi and Tom Savini, I think anybody with any sort of acumen at all would consider that to be a person of expert level status in this particular area of expertise and knowledge. So. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and push back on you on that. I consider you an expert. And that's why when we realized, we're looking back over this and we thought to ourselves, you know, we haven't really talked much about horror movies. And I said, well, I know the perfect person who we can bring on who'd be able to blow us out of the water with what she knows about this genre and just, you know, the experiences she's had with it. So that is, that was, you know, one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to talk to you today.
Have you guys had a woman on the show before?
Yes.
Yes.
Have you? Okay. I haven't listened to every episode, but
even prior to having Jim on the episode or on the podcast as a co-host, I had I had a couple of guests that were not only women. I think I had a trans woman. I had I've had all sorts of people on this. I'm lucky. I'm very lucky to have a very wide circle of friends and co-conspirators who kind of cover every aspect of the rainbow and spectrum. So I'm really lucky talked to in that particular regard.
A radio DJ up in the PNW from where Saints from. Right, we talked to Taryn Daly.
Yeah.
We talked to our friend Kaylee Cortez, who is a musician who does dark wave EDM music.
Nuda, yeah, she's great.
Yep.
Well, good.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad that there's that other women, because I feel like you know, the female perspective, especially in like fandom and nerd circles and stuff, is kind of valuable. Like, I feel like we come at it from a little bit of a different angle. And I know there are definitely a lot of women that are into horror movies and stuff, but not a lot of women that want to talk about it. You know, I don't have a ton of female friends that are into horror the way that I am. And if I do have them, I've met them at the convention, you know. It's one of those things, like, I go to a Tool concert and I'm like, there's this many people at a Tool concert. Well, where are you all in my regular life? You know, it's like, I don't run into them out on the street, but once we all gather in the same place, you know, then all of
you
a
like
sudden,
Tool, do
how
you?
Many there are. I love Tool.
He's a big Tool fan.
Yeah.
I was, I actually fronted a Tool tribute band for about 5 years.
I heard that in one of your previous episodes. Impressive.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I wouldn't go so far as to say
until it got too hard, but, right?
Well, no, we started it before we knew it would be that hard, and once we got into it, once we started cracking into like the quote unquote time signatures of their music, it's like, why the fuck are we doing this? It's too late now. We're
Jim knows all about that. How hard Tool songs are, and
a little bit, yeah. And we only do a couple of them in our set, but you know, it's and there's a reason why we don't do stuff like Lateralis and 46 and 2, because we're like, you know, the timing on Stinkfist is hard enough to get down with how mushy the bridge is. But you know, that's just man was a genius, so that's how that goes.
Well,
but
and it's sort of the equivalent of like giving your child a name that they will never find on one of those gas station keychain displays. Like, Tool is a band that's really hard to cover, and I appreciate that about them.
Absolutely. And again, like I always tell people, it's like, if I'd have known how difficult it was going in, I probably would have said, no, let's cover something more conventional. Let's do Megadeth. Let's do Metallica. Let's do something more conventional. But we started doing it and I had fun with it. And then we kept doing it and I had fun with it. And then by the time we got into the complicated shit, it's like, well, fuck, we're pot committed at this point.
A penny, in for a pound, I guess.
That's right. But, well, why don't you tell us, Ms. Katie Cadaver, where everybody can find you on social media, find your podcast, find more about you, and give you a chance to sell yourself here.
Sure. I'm all over the place. Katie Cadaver, that's Cadaver with a K. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram. I'm also a little bit on TikTok, not much. And also on Patreon, if you're sort of into the spicy content, you can find me over there. I also do some modeling and some things on Patreon. And then the VHS Vault, we are on Instagram and Facebook, and then you can stream us on Spotify and all those other names of podcast platforms that have been changing and going away and coming back and whatever. wherever fine podcasts are streamed, you can find us there. And then, you know,
that sounds familiar.
Yeah, check out our... check out our Facebook and Instagram pages. It's been a little bit quiet because we're in between seasons at the moment. But there's we have a whole first season of 20 episodes. We covered a lot of movies and also talked about a lot of just other crazy things about horror movies. We played Fuck, Marry, Kill and did it with like horror movie titles and different villains and all kinds of stuff. So we had a lot of fun with the horror genre, as well as reviewing some movies from the vault. There's some great episodes. We cover Redneck Zombies, Microwave Massacre. You can't go wrong. Just pick an episode. Start anywhere. It's wild. So,
and of course, Grindhouse Tees Burlesque is also online.
Yes, Grindhouse Tees. That's on Facebook currently. And if you follow me, I always share when we have shows coming up. right now we're kind of on a break. I realized that I hadn't taken a break from burlesque in like 2 years to like catch up my breath at all. So there was a little bit of an opportunity to sort of take a sabbatical from booking any shows at the moment. So we don't have anything on the books right now, but that could change in a matter of weeks. You know, usually those things pop up quickly. So I've got some ideas swirling around in my head. It's just a matter of, you know, booking a date. So stay tuned to my Facebook and Instagram for updates on all of that.
Fun.
Sweet. We shall do. Well, Katie, we want to thank you for coming on the podcast today. It's been a barrel of blood. I mean, laughs. And
it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to checking out some of the movies that you recommended. So I appreciate those.
Absolutely. And if you ever need more recommendations, just hit me up. I've got lists on lists. So
I'm sure you do. But we want to thank you for joining us on the podcast. Again, we want to remind everybody out there that, again, if you should want to get in touch with us at the Fuel Your Fandom Podcast, there are a couple of different ways you can do that. Hit us up at Facebook, facebook.com/FuelYourFandom. Drop us a line at FuelYourFandom@gmail.com.
Or at FYFTalentBooking@gmail.com. And, of course, we're on Threads and Instagram at FuelYourFandom. And you can find us anywhere fine podcasts are sold, stolen, traded, bartered, and all that. So, yeah, thanks again to Katie for coming on the show today. And we look forward to checking out your future projects. And, yeah, good times.
Good
times.
Thanks,
guys.
Well, we want to thank you all for listening to another episode of the Fuel Your Fandom Podcast. And please do remember that everything is fandom, and fandom is everything. Take care.
Oh, God, yeah. I waxed my nostrils. I waxed my nostrils and my ears. Yeah.
But not your pubes.
Because of... No, well, no, I don't. Because it's like, that's another one of those things that, like, well, I do the... Well, I'd have to go somewhere to do the business. But like,
I can
do
the ear holes. I got a girl.
I can do the ears and the nose at home. That's I can do that with the... I can just heat up the shit in the microwave.
Oh, Jim.
Like,
yoink, yoink. No, Jim. She's got a girl. Go. Do it.
Yeah. Get the and baseball wax, they call it. The
I
baseball
can't
wax.
Recommend
it's balls,
it
bat,
enough.
And dugout. Yeah.